This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Bears pushed on with their grisly march down Wall Street today. Investors are just plain sick of the daily barrage of awfulness out of the economy. They're pretty sure it's going to get worse. Not even the Fed chairman could convince them otherwise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the 17th day of January. The carnage continued on Wall Street today. The Dow dropped more than 300 points. The S&P 500 fell below its low of last year. Today's blame goes in part to almost $10 billion in losses at Merrill Lynch. And it didn't help that last month's housing starts fell to their lowest level since 1991. The president is scheduled to outline his criteria for a stimulus package tomorrow. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told lawmakers on Capitol Hill today that he supports an immediate but short-term plan to get cash into the hands of consumers. But he also characterized the economy as still, quote, resilient. Question is, does anybody believe him? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes a look.
Bernanke wasn't exactly cheerful when he testified today before the House Budget Committee. He said the downside risks to economic growth this year have, quote, become more pronounced. But Bernanke insisted the Fed was not forecasting a recession.
Well, we currently see the economy as continuing to grow, but growing at a relatively slow pace, particularly in the first half of this year.
Ohio Democrat Marcy Kaptur, a member of the committee, found Bernanke unconvincing. She says she knows he didn't want to spook Wall Street by using the R word, but she wishes he would have acknowledged the pain her district feels from unemployment and the subprime mess.
I think his comments were more for the New York markets, and they actually don't reflect the reality of what the American people have been experiencing. A majority of the American people believe we're in recession.
Investors appear to agree. Stocks took a dive as Bernanke started speaking. Economist Bernie Baumol of the Economic Outlook Group says there's a better than 50% chance of a recession, but that's in the first quarter of this year. He says Bernanke's testimony today was right on the mark.
It's a very clever answer because you can still have one or two quarters of recession and for the year as a whole still have growth. He just didn't want to use the R word.
There was one R word Wall Street did want to hear, rate, as in interest rate cuts. Bernanke pledged the Fed would lower a key interest rate when it meets later this month. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have endured punishing headlines the last few years. They barely weathered a massive accounting scandal. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo is now investigating whether Fannie bought up mortgages that were based on inflated home appraisals. Congress has been pushing heavier regulation of the two. But that was before the housing bubble popped and the credit crunch hit. Now Washington wants Fannie and Freddie to play white knights. Jill Barchet reports.
Mortgage lenders have been stingy about issuing home loans since credit tightened back in August. The Bush administration wants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to step in and raise more money to buy more mortgages. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She says the government is scaling back a plan that would have made Fannie and Freddie get permission to issue debt four times a year.
It's a 180-degree turnaround from where Washington was at the earlier part of this decade, trying to clip the wings of Fannie and Freddie Mac because they felt they were getting too big for themselves.
The hope is that mortgage lenders will issue new home loans with the money they get from Fannie and Freddie. Carl Case is a housing economist at Wellesley College.
It's certainly true that there's a lack of credit for people with reasonably good credit standards at the bottom end of the income distribution. And this will provide some resources to get those people into houses.
But Case says banks might just use the proceeds to clean up their balance sheets instead of issuing more mortgages. And then there's the danger, he says, that Fannie and Freddie could get knocked down by the housing crisis.
If they're borrowing money to put into mortgages and the mortgage market declines further, or this thing spreads further than it's even spread now, then it's a jeopardy. So there's certainly a risk involved.
Both Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored enterprises. That means there's an implicit promise taxpayers will bail them out if they run into trouble. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
The wind industry released some new stats today that it hopes will blow skeptics away. According to the American Wind Energy Association, wind power grew 45% last year. For the first time, energy from wind turbines accounted for more than 1% of the electricity produced in this country. But as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, the industry has a few storms on the horizon.
Wind power has made impressive headway in the last few years. Its success is due in part to the 25 states that have passed so-called renewable portfolio standards. Those laws require that a certain percentage of a state's electricity come from green power. But while industry officials celebrate their success, the business is suffering some growing pains. There's a shortage of wind turbines, for one. Wind power entrepreneur Doug Selsom.
There's only so many factories in the world that can produce the fiberglass. There are only so many factories that can produce the resins that go together, and those resins essentially come from oil.
But the industry is more nervous about losing subsidies. Congress failed to include wind production tax credits in the latest energy bill, and the current credits are due to expire this year. Greg Whetstone at the American Wind Energy Association says here's what his group's members are hearing.
They're seeing investors take a step back in terms of how much they're willing to step forward and say, you know, let's move forward. We want to continue to build a renewable industry. They want to know what the tax policies are.
There was good news, however, for the country's first offshore wind farm this week. A government report concluded that the Cape Wind project off Nantucket would have no major environmental impact. Nearby residents, including the Kennedy family, are fighting that project. They gripe about marring the view, the potential noise, and the impact on bird life. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
As we've mentioned already, it was a brutal day on Wall Street. Every blue chip stock ended lower. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Most of us get billed the same amount every month for our internet connections, no matter how much or how little we surf the web. But Time Warner Cable is looking into a new business model. The country's second biggest cable provider says it's planning to test a system where internet subscribers pay for the amount of data they download. Not good news for anyone who likes watching movies and music videos online. Ashley Montite has that story.
Time Warner Cable starts testing in Beaumont, Texas later this year. Company spokesman Alex Dudley blames a small number of bandwidth hogs.
Less than 5% of our users are at times using up to 50% of our network, which means that they are negatively impacting the experience for the rest of our customers.
He says the trial will tier customers based on how many gigabytes of data they download each month. He says the company hasn't decided how much each group will pay. But Porter Bibb of MediaTek Capital Partners doesn't believe light internet users will pay any less, and he says Time Warner will charge heavy users a premium.
And that's simply not going to fly. It's as nonsensical as saying if you have cable television and you don't watch much television, you're going to pay less than somebody who watches 24/7.
Bibb says this is just a way for cable companies to get an early piece of the online video pie. But Declan McCullough of CNET says internet service providers need to try new pricing models because all that video clogs their pipes.
It's very expensive to build new pipes. And so what do you do? I think we're going to see experimentation. We're going to see some ISPs try to charge. We're going to see other ISPs, and Comcast is already doing this, trying to throttle.
That is slow down the speed of the connection for those who use a lot of bandwidth. He says U.S. consumers may have got used to all-in-one pricing for internet use, but he says bandwidth could eventually be like any other utility, where the free market dictates how much we pay. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Here's another thing you might not want to download if you're paying based on bandwidth, a four-hour baseball game. But while that cost is currently part of the package, sports leagues are still figuring out the best ways to put their content online. Earlier this week, the Sports Business Journal reported that the NBA is going to allow its teams to sell their own digital rights. To explain further, we've invited Ed Dursey, our Business of Sports commentator, who also happens to be the Vice President of Interactive Media for Fox Sports International. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Tess.
So tell me how this works. This is essentially the local teams, the Blazers, the 76ers, the Clippers, able to put their own games on the internet.
For the most part, that is exactly correct. What the NBA is planning to do is grant the teams, the local teams, the rights to exploit the digital rights for their local games. Now, remember, the NBA just completed an extension of its national rights deals with ABC, ESPN, and TNT. 8 years at $7.4 billion. And part of those rights deals was the ability to exploit the games on all platforms possible, including social content platforms. So you could see in a couple of years ESPN allowing people to do NBA mashups, for example.
Is this a surprise that a league would actually go for this strategy?
No, I don't think it really is a surprise. I think that the NBA is looking down the road a little bit, and it, you know, aligns with their broadcast rights strategy. They've got their national deals, they have their local deals, and they want all of the rights, both traditional broadcasts and the digital rights, to align with each other and offer them as single packages to regional sports networks or anybody else that might come along. It does differ from the existing models that you have.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Major League Baseball, the NFL, do not do this.
No, MLB and the NFL, through their digital arms, have owned and controlled the digital rights exclusively. So the NFL, for example, has an exclusive rights deal with Sprint, and all of the mobile highlights go exclusively to Sprint. But the NFL, the league itself, controls that, not the teams and not the broadcasters.
What is the advantage of the NBA model now?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First, let's look at the local aspect. About 142 games that go to ABC, ESPN, and TNT. That leaves about another 850 games over the course of the season to be exploited. And the league, rightly so, realizes that the local teams are the best people to promote whatever products they have, whether it's the basketball team itself, some kind of promotion, or the digital rights. It also provides additional or protective value, if you will, for the teams when they're trying to negotiate these kinds of deals with the regional sports networks, because now you don't have digital rights out there competing with, you know, the television rights. You align them together, and it's a better financial proposition for the teams.
What do you think? Is it a good model?
Well, from a broadcaster's point of view, and I work for a broadcaster, I think it's a good model. It's a logical one that aligns the interests of the broadcasters and the leagues themselves. When you start to parry these things out in a convergent world where people really do consume on multiple platforms, the technology is now reaching mass adoption to consume via broadband. But the business models really aren't the same. The digital rights are worth tens of millions of dollars, and the broadcast rights are worth billions of dollars. So if you have everybody able to consume on digital platforms for rights that go for a lot less, you're going to threaten the more valuable rights that come with your core broadcast deals.
Do you watch the Lakers on a 2-inch screen?
Do I watch the Lakers? I watch a lot of stuff on a lot of screens. I mean, look, if I have the choice to sit and watch a game in front of my television, quote, set, or on my laptop or on the iPod, most of the time, given free time, I watch it on television. But I move around a lot. I travel a lot. And so do a lot of other people. And the younger consumer adjusts his expectation to the size of the screen and increasingly prefers that mobility over being forced to sit down and be tied to a television set.
All right. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome, Tess.
Ed Dersey is the Vice President of Interactive Media for Fox Sports International, but when he comes and visits with us, his views are his own. Imagine San Diego is one big Peloton today. Thousands of cyclists are converging there for the Bicycle Leadership Conference. They'll be figuring out how to expand the bicycle market. One obvious answer? Get more commuters to ride their bikes to work. On that score, Portland, Oregon is way out front of the pack. According to Bicycling Magazine, the city has the highest number of bike commuters in the country. Ethan Lindsay of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports on the industry that's grown up around all those riders.
To many bicyclists, Portland is the closest an American city has come to getting it right. The city has bike boulevards, bike passing lanes, even bike traffic jams. And on Sunday nights, it has Zubong.
If you see a car, you say, car! Car!
3, 2, 1, 4!
Zubong is a weekly race down one of the city's biggest hills. Of the 40 or so racers, about half bomb the hill on tricked-out kiddie bikes. Yet, this is only one spoke in Portland's bicycle culture. This city has been considered one of the most bike-friendly in the country ever since the 1970s. That's when lawmakers passed Oregon's bicycle bill, sending 1% of all road money to bicycle infrastructure.
So once infrastructure that made biking safe and feasible and possible was there, people started doing it in greater numbers.
Jonathan Moss edits the blog bikeportland.org.
It's just sort of a big snowball. Now people move here because it's safe for bikes and it's possible to live without a car. Out of that, you start essentially creating markets that don't exist in other cities.
Moss points to fears of gas prices and global warming. He says those car concerns could help Portland become a capital city in the bike business. In a report for the city last year, a planning firm estimated the bike industry employs 600 to 800 people at about 125 different companies. Moss, the blogger, says Portland is in the process of attracting even more bike companies, including some bigger names with larger payrolls. Yakima Products is one of the world's biggest makers of bike racks. It employs almost 100 people. About 10 years ago, the company outgrew its original offices in Arcata, California. Chris Sauter's a developer with the company. He says the Portland area seemed an ideal new home.
There's a large group of people in industry that know about bikes, or and if they don't know, they know somebody who does. There's a knowledge base.
Sasha White builds high-end bikes by hand at his small Portland shop. Many say his bike frames are the best in the world, which is why they cost $10,000 each, and there's a 5-year waiting list.
I'm still the sole builder. I want to be that kind of village craftsman, you know, where, back in the old days, people in the community were coming to the knife maker for a knife.
White says he doesn't want the city to grow so big that it becomes the Detroit of the bicycle age. But in the meantime, Portland continues to be home to more and more bike riders. And with more riders come more shops, more jobs, and more injuries.
If you crash, don't die. Get out of the way so no one runs you over. Follow us, you'll get to the bottom. It'll be sweet.
More death-defying stunts. In Portland, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
And we have some video of that downhill race that Ethan mentioned on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the messy details of divorce in Britain.
Nobody knows what the court's going to do. It's a tragedy. I mean, even people who are doing these cases for a long time don't know. So if you line up 4 divorce laws, you'll get at least 6 different answers.
But first, let's do the numbers. So much for all that talk about jump-starting the economy. All it started today was a massive sell-off. The Dow plummeted 306 points, 2.4% to finish at 12,159. That makes for the market's worst three-day decline since 2002. The Nasdaq lopped off 47 points, 2% to end at 2,346. The S&P 500 gave up 39 points, 2.9% to finish at 1,333. Financial stocks led the decline. Merrill Lynch fell more than 10% after reporting that huge loss. Washington Mutual lost nearly 7%, and Bank of America tumbled 4.6%. News that builders broke ground in December on the fewest houses since 1991, well, that sent mortgage lenders into the basement. Fannie Mae lost more than 6%, and Freddie Mac gave up more than 7%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Grocery Manufacturers Association wraps up a two-day summit on environmentally sustainable business practices in the beverage, food, and consumer products industry. Pre-sliced bread was banned on January 18, 1943, the wartime effort aimed to reduce metal replacement parts for bakeries. And Oliver Hardy was born on tomorrow's date in 1892. He was half of the comedy team Laurel and Hardy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. The show must go on, or must it? Organizers of the Academy Awards are scrambling to figure out what to do if the Hollywood writers' strike is still in effect during the February 24th Festival of Pomp and Self-Congratulation. So far, nobody's worrying about the Emmys, which usually fall in September. But commentator and Emmy-nominated writer Doug Cordell says anyone writing TV for kids deserves more than a statue anyway.
I never set out to write for kids' TV. But like most playwrights with lofty ambitions, I was broke. So when a friend offered to hook me up with a broadcast puppet show, I panted, yes. How hard could it be, writing for four-year-olds? In my interview, the producer asked why I wanted to write for children's television. Well, I said, stalling, I like children, and I like television. They hired me anyway. It turned out to be more than I bargained for. For one thing, it wasn't the cynical Krusty the Clown atmosphere I'd been banking on. Everyone took the show extremely seriously, especially the puppeteers, several of whom stayed in character during lunch. And because of the target audience, none of the characters themselves, the bear, the pig, the rabbit, and so on, could lie or even be disagreeable to one another. Conflict being an essential ingredient in drama, I practically got an aneurysm coming up with the story. Then at the script read-through, the producer had a problem with my idea of the rabbit getting running shoes. Rabbits don't wear shoes, he said with a smirk in front of the cast and crew. He's wearing a vest, I pointed out. The vest is part of his character, he said solemnly, and the script assistant made a note. Meanwhile, the pressure to crank out material was intense. My back went out, and I couldn't sleep. One of the other writers gave me sleeping pills, which worked okay, except they made you surly enough by the afternoon to want to eat glass. By the end of the season, I was editing scripts on my back on the office floor. But I was a celebrity to my nieces and nephews. I'd also gotten a date with the cute girl who tended the bear puppet, and I'd made good money. Months later, we were nominated for an Emmy, and I was surprisingly disappointed when we lost to a show about singing vowels. Now really, I thought, how hard could that be to write?
Doug Cordell is a writer living here in Los Angeles. Are you watching less TV because of the writer's strike? Let us know. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Next week, member states of the European Union are meeting to discuss divorce reform. Divorce can be ugly no matter where it takes place, but breaking up in England is particularly hard to do. Divorce laws there are decades old. Prenups aren't even recognized by the courts. But if love's not in the air, change is. From London, Jeff Brumfield reports.
20 years ago, two characters on the popular British soap opera EastEnders shocked the nation by getting a divorce.
This, my sweet, is a letter from my solicitor telling you that your husband has filed a petition for divorce. It also tells you to get yourself a solicitor pretty damn quick.
British television has come a long way since then. The country's divorce laws, on the other hand, haven't changed since 1973. Prenuptial agreements, now common in many countries, aren't considered legally binding in England. That's because of the government's traditional attitude towards marriage, according to Pauline Fowler, a divorce lawyer at Hughes Fowler Carruthers, a London firm.
Old-fashioned view of it was that it was against public policy to encourage people to try to have an agreement before they got married, because they somehow regarded that as being anti-marriage.
Instead, it's up to judges to decide how to split up the assets. They have such wide latitude that even divorce lawyers can't predict what will happen. James Peary, with Family Law and Partnerships, says couples often spend $80,000 or more each to settle a case.
Nobody knows what the court's going to do. It's a tragedy. I mean, even people who are doing these cases for a long time don't know. So if you line up four divorce lawyers, you'll get at least six different answers.
For the rich, the problem gets worse. Not only do the courts not enforce prenups, but judges consider all the assets of each partner, not just those gained during the marriage. That's earned London a new and unwelcome title, Divorce Capital of the World.
Anybody wishing to maximize their potential divorce entitlement will try and ensure that it is dealt with in the courts of London.
Jeremy Levinson handles the divorces of rock stars, executives, and anyone willing to pay his $840 an hour rate. He says these days settlements often run into the tens of millions of dollars. In many cases, one or both spouses are foreigners, and that leads to a frantic race. The wife, and it often is a woman, will rush to file in London while the husband seeks to settle the case in another country. It's called forum shopping.
We love these forum shop cases. They're interesting and they're fascinating. They're great fun. And at the bottom of the line, they're very lucrative for us to deal with.
But the location game might be coming to an end. London's courts are clogged, and sorting out couples' finances can easily take over a year. So judges are beginning to use prenuptial contracts as a guide for divvying up assets, according to Fowler.
I think there is a shift towards honouring prenups. I don't think anybody's quite made the leap yet to honour them, but there's certainly a shift.
In the absence of new divorce laws, prenups could be the only way to bring order to billionaire breakups. Again, James Peary.
Some of the figures that we see going through the courts, I'm going, why are you doing this? You know, you're not going to get through 10 million in the rest of your life, so why are we fighting over the last eight? You know, never mind.
You know it's time for a change when even divorce lawyers are getting fed up. In London, I'm Jeff Brumfield for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And late-breaking news from Hollywood. The writers are still on strike, but it looks like the directors may have averted one. The Directors Guild of America has been in contract negotiations with Hollywood producers since last week. The Guild has confirmed it struck a deal today. The director's contract may pave the way for a settlement of the writer's strike that's dragged on for more than 2 months and involves many of the same issues. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 306 points, 2 4/10%. The Nasdaq fell 47 points, 1 9/10%. And the S&P 500 dropped 39 points, that's 2 9/10%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, an automotive CEO steers his company in a new direction.
I really believe that my experiences in 37 years in the airplane business would be so transferable to Ford, and I'd actually be able to help.
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time with CEO Alan Mulally. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.